I just figured out that being here for 2 months was possibly a big mistake, because I kept asking Tom a lot of questions about this model and that model. And so when he came up to his conference of ignorance, he immediately picked me as the first person to talk in it. I'm not certain that I have much to say here, and I'm struggling to get a team together here, because to some extent you've heard some of the problems that one faces from Alexei and others. But I'll still press on nonetheless, because they've essentially rendered half my overheads unnecessary. So this is going to be a quick talk. But I want to share with you some of the motivation for this work. And it comes out of a collaborative exercise with a large cast that you see here. And our essential interest has been, because of the history of our participation in extensional rheology, is to try and see whether some of the techniques that we develop for solutions is applicable for entangled solutions. And of course, when we started on this, it was fairly obvious that there's not much difference between solutions and melts. And now we're not so sure, and perhaps you can enlighten us on this. The technique, a lot of you may have seen this video, but for those who haven't seen, just to put it in perspective, I'll just run it, it doesn't take much time. So the technique that we're using here is essentially to try and have a liquid bridge which is extended in a fairly controlled manner in order to form a fairly long filament. You need to measure the diameter in order to be able to get the strain rates and the forces in order to be able to do that. And there's been a whole history of work on this for dilute solutions, which has essentially convinced us that we are indeed having an extensional flow field and that the stresses we measure are reasonable. And the video you see there is on a very dilute solution, what we call a Boger fluid. And here's some reason why we believe it's important to show that we actually do get acceptable data from three different labs, which for those who haven't been involved in this game is a major achievement, because here's two graphs, one from 1989, which shows about 8 orders of magnitude difference in the data from the same lab, for the same solution from different labs, and the other one, which are much more recent data, of course, unfortunately using the same technique, but from 3 different labs. And at least in this case, we do get the same answers, and that shows that we can measure diameter and forces the same way in the northern hemisphere as we can in the southern hemisphere. Now the question is that having had this technique, then we went about looking for where we can apply this and try and contribute to the rheology. And there's a whole host of studies we have done, both in the dilute and the semi-dilute and the entangled. And what we are currently trying to look at is these set of data that we have in the... it's easier to do it here, isn't it? These set of data we have in the entangled system, and I won't go back to it. You might ask whether this technique actually works as well for the entangled systems as it does for the dilute solutions. And in some cases, for the very low strain rates, we need to do this in a liquid, in a plateau tank. But more or less, it does work well here. And here's the polystyrene solution that Alexei talked about and that we're going to look at. And you can see that you do get essentially uniform deformation, and we can also stop the flow, and that's what happens. And you can, under certain limited conditions, get a fairly good measure of the relaxation of the stresses after extension also. So the question is that we started with the full-blown model, or at least what we thought was the most comprehensive model at this time, which contains essentially all the additional relaxation mechanisms that one needs other than reptation itself, except that this model, the Mead-Larsen-Doi model, does not have constraint release. The problem then comes about, what we've already talked about, is to try and figure out these parameters which enter into the theory. And I don't have to say very much more, because these have been canvassed. What we started doing was essentially to try and get the plateau modulus simply from the plateau modulus, published plateau modulus for the melt and scale it with concentration and thereby calculate the number of entanglements. And then we have essentially one time constant because the disengagement time and the Rouse time are related by the number of entanglements. So essentially it comes back to the same single time constant model problem. And what we were not certain about at that stage was what kind of time constant to use. It's useful to look at the data also. And I might mention that the reason I'm skipping over some of these issues of the modeling issues is that Gary Leal is going to talk, or at least talk about some parts of this in the more detailed talk next week. So these are the typical kind of stress growth curves or the viscosity growth curves that you get. And in most cases, over a window of strain rates, which is limited by the experimental resolution, or by breakage at the higher strain rates, we can get both the steady state extensional viscosity and the stresses. And if one looks at the scale stresses, you see that it essentially covers the regions in which we expect most of these relaxation mechanisms to operate. That is, there is a region of very low stresses, which are essentially in the Newtonian region. Then as the orientation saturates, you see the sign of the stress also saturating, and eventually at much higher strain rates than of order of the inverse Rouse time, the chain stretch becomes important, and therefore you get an additional increase in a large increase in the stresses itself. Therefore, the data essentially covers all the regions that one ought to be interested in. And if you look at it in terms of the Troughton ratio, as a lot of us like to do, then you see that again, there is, for this case here, which has got 15 entanglements, you get a very a small region of strain rate thinning, and then of course quite a large region of chain stretch kicking in. And in fact, as far as we know, this is probably one of the most definitive evidence for the tube stretch taking place at about the Rise time constant. So one could possibly use this data in order to try and evaluate the time constant that one likes, and therefore one could, if we have better data or enough data between in this region, one could estimate the inverse reptation time from where the strain rate, where the Troughton ratio decreases, and one could probably estimate the inverse Rouse time from where the chain stretch kicks in. And these are essentially consistent with what you would like. However, there are some problems. This is not the true disengagement time, but it is what one would call the longest relaxation time that you can measure experimentally. That means it carries within it all the information about contour length fluctuations. It carries information about constraint release also. And therefore, one needs, in some way, some kind of a model in order to deduce the reptation time or the true disengagement time from the experimentally measured relaxation time there. And once you do that, of course, then you could probably see whether this corresponds to the Rouse time, and therefore the spacing between the disengagement time and the Rouse time is correct. Mike?
Are you saying that this time differs from the normal linear
it is the same as the terminal time.
It's the same as terminal time.
Yeah.
So
if you estimate what, yeah, if you try and fit only the terminal part of the last modulus or the storage modulus, you'll get exactly the same time.
There's no
prefactors. No. I'm sorry?
Yeah,
oh, it has been checked. I'll come to that in a minute. The problem is that that does not give you the true disengagement time. So it essentially converts it into a two-parameter model where you independently estimate the longest relaxation time and also the Rouse time by some means. And there's no way of calculating the Rouse time from the measured longest relaxation time except through the intervention of some model which describes contour length fluctuation and constraint release, which again comes back to the problem that everyone's been discussing till now. Of course, if you, and it's not quite true that the solutions are a class of lightly entangled. Here's an experiment with only 15% polystyrene, and essentially the student ran out of patients making more solutions, but there's no reason why one can't go to a bit more entangled system. But here's one which is about 40 entanglements, which is not very different from the kind of entanglement densities that one talks about in when you're doing pure melts itself. There's one difference, of course. One big difference is that the molecular weight between entanglements is much larger in solutions than it is in melts. And what effect that has is something that you might want to think about. So in these cases, when you have very high entanglements, then the picture is much clearer, that you do have a much broader region over which the strain rate softening takes place. And of course, a much narrower region over chain stretch takes place because breakage becomes important, and that's not something I want to talk about. Again, I purposely eliminated all theoretical predictions from this because that's quite a different topic.
You're presenting genuine steady state.
As far as we know, yes.
Some of your experiments do not reach that steady state condition.
They'll break before steady state. So some experiments at the highest strain rate end will break, will rupture before steady
otherwise
state.
Otherwise, you have a period of the experiment where you can raise a constant.
Reasonable. In some cases, it is more pronounced. In some other cases, it's possibly slightly below. If anything, it is an underestimate of the actual stresses in the viscosity. So it might be slightly larger. There are experimental problems at the highest strains. In order to maintain that. But within those reasons, yes, I'm quite happy with claiming that these are extensions. So here are the predictions. These are predictions that are from the Milner-McLeish model, which Ron's talked about. It's done with as much understanding of all the parameter values that he's talked about. So this doesn't have the 4/5 and all the other problems that are involved in it. And in fact, to some extent, this is what got us quite concerned about some of these prefactors. But you see one problem, which Alexa actually mentioned, but his code, the one he showed, does include constraint release. And of course, he has his additional parameter, which he showed you need to use quite large values in order to get some prediction. But we go a bit further than that. And when a large number of people have commented on this lack of fit between in the intermediate frequencies, but as far as I'm concerned, that seems to be the best one can do without making any of the other assumptions that we come across. And you'll see that in each of these cases, and there are more data that I won't bother showing you, the theoretical predictions of the Milner-McLeish model consistently underpredicts the experimental data by a far greater amount than you've seen earlier in the MELT data. In fact, when you look at this and then go back and think about the kind of data that Ron was showing, the predictions there are much, much superior to what you find here. And to answer Mike's question, you'll see that the time constant that we get from fitting the terminal regime here is essentially exactly what you'll find when you get the time constant from the extensional data.
But different sets of data, the same chemical needle, they overlap or not? If you change concentration,
yes,
and molecular weight, the same chemical needle is the
same. Yes, they do.
Can
it
superimpose it?
Yeah.
There's
not that many MELT data available.
There's no MELT data.
Not sufficient number of MELT data that will scan. I don't think that there is. I have not seen a.
There's no sufficient yet. Which you have.
No, but there is a need of consistent, of going consistently from solution to the melt smoothly and see whether you see break, the agreement break. Yeah.
Okay. So the only thing that fits the melt and doesn't fit at all, but nothing that can be super well to the same.
Yeah, it does.
No, you're going to tell me, hang on a minute, let's get this clear. Are you asking about superposition of the dynamic data?
Right.
Or are you talking about the extensional data?
Dynamic.
I'll cut to that. I'll show you the superposition in a minute. I'm sorry, I thought you were talking about the extensional data, and therefore I wasn't able to answer that.
Does your theory, the calculation of the theory have the C nu in it?
No. That's the original Milner-McLeish, which doesn't have constraint release.
Okay, no constraint
release. No constraint release. The data, the fitting that Alexa showed just just before he wound up his talk, actually has constrained release, but also in spite of that involves this parameter, as he mentioned, which is required to take on large values. Whether that is realistic or not is not something I want to comment about. Okay, here's three sets of solutions from three different labs, I think, where you'll see that there's good superposition between the G prime and G double prime. These are just shifted around to show that essentially you get the same shapes, nothing more than that. There is one, the same number of entanglements.
Defined by
the way Ron just discussed this.
If alpha is 1 or alpha is 4/3 or something else.
Yes, yeah.
No. These are just shifting. I have not put any model in it. I've just shifted the curves vertically by approximately the Plateau modulus and horizontally in order to, by approximately the tau e that one would expect.
But different molecular weights, in fact.
These are different molecular weights. These are different concentrations, different molecular weights, except they have the same number of entanglements, except, I'll just finish this and come back to you, except that this one, which has got a much higher number of entanglements, and therefore the Rouse time is shifted. So I'm not really interested in what's happening about that. I'm trying to concentrate here and show that this is not a peculiar phenomenon with our experimental data, but is something that you'll consistently find with a large number of solution data. Mike?
What does that number have over here for what number is
it? 25. I think this one is about 40. This is the one I showed you earlier with 40. The others are around 25. I can look up the data. I can't. 10% of that order.
They're all
10%? No, 7%, 10%. There's one at 15% there.
It's not a big range.
It's not a huge range, but it is a range.
It doesn't say anything that if you order up with a higher concentration, 50%.
No. No. I'll come to MEL data. I'm just showing you that the picture for solutions is consistent with each other. And if you now try and superpose MEL data and solution data, this is what happens. You'll see again here is one set, and there's a large number of sets which I haven't showed you. Both polystyrene, both 40 entanglements. And here all I've again done is just shifted, and you'll see that the MEL data here is consistently lower than the solution data. The solution does not exhibit any slope there at all. It's essentially very shallow, unlike what you'd expect from, again, this is another one where the MEL data does not go up to high enough frequency, but you can see that there are, and that's at 26 entanglements. And here's just my understanding or misunderstanding of some of the theoretical work we're talking about, that the reptation signature here, you expect a slope of -1/2, and that when you put in contour length fluctuations or constraint release, that scaling changes to about -1/4. So it's
the initial scaling should be 1/2.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah. I think I was swapping between storage modulus and last modulus, but quite right. And the problem is here, there are very few data unless you go to extraordinary variation in the temperature and believe in time temperature superposition over a large range of temperatures. It is not possible to get the high frequency. But what my point here is that there is no mechanism here that allows you, that predicts essentially a zero slope for the last modulus in the intermediate regions. That is consistent with what we see here. So essentially that's the question or the problem that I see it, that the general trends are obviously captured, and when Gary gives a talk, you'll see that if we blindly use Milner-McLeish model, fit the reptation time from that, in fact, even if necessary, ignore constraint release, we get an extremely good prediction. In fact, you can go ahead and throw everything away and say it's a nonlinear flow, chain stretching is the only important thing, and you do very well. And therefore, you could use extremely simple models in complex flow calculation, but that's a message that possibly Gary will convince you about. But the point here is that are there any missing physics that is peculiar to solutions that one doesn't find in MELS? And the point to remember, as I said, is that these are systems wherein the molecular weight between entanglements is much larger, of the order of magnitude larger than you would find. But there might be other interesting subtle physics that is actually missing that might contribute to this relaxation. And I thought Tom wanted to say something at this stage. A conjecture, if you like.
Yeah.
Can I just point out, in our measurements of hydrogenated...
Yeah, I was going to mention that, because when I said that, I started off thinking that MELS and solutions are the same. I thought it was your paper that convinced me about that, about diffusion measurements.
Well, our G double prime curves for a range of molecular weights and concentrations of the MELS and solutions of 20% all overlap pretty well. And they had a stronger than expected slope, you know, not a small than expected slope. The absolute magnitude of any nothing like as big as this.
Yes, with that they will be much smaller.
But if you know, if the argument is that solutions are fundamentally different than MELS, I don't think you can say that.
No, I'm not saying that. But on the other hand, I believe that there is one has to keep. Our options open that there might be smaller. It's not a big difference. It's smaller, subtle physics that might actually be contributing to solutions rather than that.
Comment on that, but the solutions to the same number of entanglements, if they're higher in length of weight, then maybe that you typically buy these polymers in commercial stores, and maybe that they're probably first needs to get higher with higher length of weight, and that would kind of generally smear things up. So maybe worth. Putting in polydispersity in these calculations, or at least comparing the polydispersity of the material that are used.
Typically, most of the polydispersity you will also pick out in the terminal. And that, I think, for these cases, happens at much, much higher molecules. And if you go to 8 million and out, sure, even the coated polydispersity is higher. The polydispersity for these samples is not very different from. I think that the number of entanglements is definitely well-defined, at least up to 80%. Otherwise, the whole theory is indefined. So within those constraints, then there is a difference between solution and mass. I don't think polydispersity can be an answer because the kind of samples that you're using, and I have looked at, are not typically. We look at the MW or MN for these compared to the samples that you're using. They are not very different. I would be very surprised. I think they do, if you go to much higher molecular weight, they do make a difference, especially in the terminal regime, and that's not very well. Again, I mean, they possibly do help you a little bit, but I don't think that's the entire answer.
Tim, I just want to add something about this polydispersity issue, because it's a little bit misleading. Right? So you look at pressure chemical or whoever's supplier, and they got polystyrenes all the way down the map, and they say, 1.03, 1.04, 1.05, down to about a million, and then they start creeping up, 1.1, 1.15, 1.2. So, say 1.2 at the end and 1.05, that's not very different. But it is very different, because the 1.2 is really 1.2, and the 1.05 is actually 1.005. In other words, the resolution of the size exclusion chromatography is telling you that your lower molecular weight samples are much more polydispersed than they really are. But at the high molecular weight, once your measured polydispersity exceeds about 1.05, it's actually reliable. So there's a big difference. between the polydispersity of a couple of million sample and a couple of hundred thousand.
And actually, that where that polydispersity resides will affect GW. It's not even that isn't enough to actually first guess where the G prime should go, because if it's a low molecular weight tail, it'll be give you completely different rheology, or significantly different rheology, than if it's a high molecular weight tail. Or if it, you know, there's the skewness of the distribution, could give you the same number, and I suspect rather different linear rheology. Actually,
1.2 is enough to.
The high tail. To flatten out the plateau in G double primed, yeah, absolutely.
I have a question on the elongation and flow results you saw. You stipulated that the shear thinning in elongation starts at 1 over the longest relaxation time, and the uplift starts at 1 over Rouse time. Given the fact that you have dynamic modulus data, did you verify that there is such a correspondence with the relaxation times you got from the G prime and G double prime?
Yes. As I said, you will find next week when Gary gives you the entire picture that the predictions using those time constants do work very well. But you do not get consistent description of both the dynamic data and the extensional data with the same set of parameters. Tom.
Tam and I have been discussing this question. In light of these comments on polydispersity, I suspect that I'm about to say something very foolish, but just to encourage other people not to worry about saying extremely foolish things while they're here, here's a foolish thing. Suppose solutions do end up being different from melts. Are there any dynamical processes which are allowed in solutions that not in melts? So we had a think about this, and we came up with one. And you're going to think, no chance. And I should, by now, having been here for months, should know how to focus this thing. I can't even see it. So, oh, well, it'll have to do. Who knows? Oh, it's up. It's there. I'm a theoretician. God, dear. Can't trust us with anything mechanical. Actually, optimally focused in the middle anyway. Right. So they can have composition. They can entertain composition fluctuations. So you can have little bits of dense things here and little more rarefied things here. And we normally can dismiss them because they're really weak and they're really fast. And people like Dimitris measure them in Heraklion with fancy dynamic light scattering correlation equipment. There's actually a huge literature on this with the words fast mode and slow mode, and fast modes and slow modes bandied about. But all I really want to do is just to suggest that we shouldn't immediately dismiss this process as a source of rheology, not immediately, for the following reason. So the idea is that if solutions but not in melts, you can have concentration fluctuations, they're blobbing about all the time. Entanglements nail a little bit of them. Okay, so there's a piece of those concentration fluctuations that relaxes very quickly by osmotic pressure. But there's a little bit of them which doesn't. It's the little bit that's nailed in there by entanglements, which only has to wait for chains to escape. Now, these things happen at equilibrium, but of course if you shear them, just like as you shear an equilibrium orientation distribution of chain, you get stress. If you shear an equilibrium distribution of entanglement of composition fluctuations, you also get stress. Many years ago now, Ron, who's here, and Glenn Fredrickson, who's almost here, but in the building just next door, wrote a very nice paper where they showed us all how to calculate rheological contributions from composition fluctuations in anything. And then they then applied this to the sexy story of the day, which was block eponymers and long low-frequency tails at order-disorder transitions in a very beautiful way. And this is the formula. And it tells you to integrate, that you get KT, it tells you get KT per mode, right? And modes are now live in Q space. So it tells you to integrate over Q space. And what happens here is you pick up the second derivative of the scattering function with respect to the y direction, ky, when you shear in the x direction. And that's just because what you're doing is shear in real space this way is a k-space shear in that way, and you pay free energy as the curvature of your free energy goes as displacements of the scattering in the y direction, and S naught, the scattering function, is just measuring your free energy curvature. It's actually S naught to the minus one. This is a linear response calculation. Yeah, we're all in linear response. What you then need to do, so you can just plug this in, and but you then do need to know how much relaxes on what time scale. Very, very crude. There's a rather sophisticated calculation of all this by Sasha Semyonov, which, as far as we know, has not been experimentally tested in detail. We probably just about have the technology that would enable us to do this in solutions with a sort of light scattering that correlation that now exists. But basically, in a good solvent, I've got this the wrong way around. Sorry. Most of the stuff relaxes with the osmotic pressure in a cooperative diffusion. And wickly, and a little bit is the slow mode. And the slow mode is more or less the ratio of the shear modulus to the osmotic modulus, pretty much. There are, in fact, several fast modes and several slow modes. There's composition which is relaxed by Rouse fluctuation along the chain and by reptation, and everything's in there. And actually, there isn't quite a level of calculation of composition fluctuations which reflects all the processes that Tam and Ron and Alexei have talked about today. That may need to be done. Now, the slight surprise is, so can this explain any data? Can this explain high frequency shifts to the data? So I've done the difficulty is this. It all depends on the prefactor. And as Ron told you, McLeish can't calculate prefactors. He can, but he can't get them right. So what I'm about to say has the usual McLeish health warning with regard to prefactors. The difficulty is that the strength of this calculation depends upon the prefactor to the power 5. So you can see what happens. Look at this integral. You're integrating over Q space, right? So if you expand in Q, go high and high and high, 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 high Q, because you get modes and modes and modes and modes. You get lots more modes. So all the stress comes from the high Q. But the higher Q you get, you get faster and faster and faster. So you go too high Q and you get local little pieces of chain and they're never going to give you any stress. Too low and there are not enough modes. So everything is super critical, and you know, it's the cutoff to the slow mode physics is going to happen at the tube diameter. And the cutoff to the fast mode physics is going to happen at the screening length, and then you go on to at least normal sort of Onstein-Zernike scattering. It's going to be cut off at the screening length. But whether it's one or twice Q screening or three times Q screening, you find that things go Q to the fifth because you've got two Qs there, another Q, three Qs here, basically.
You're missing the factor of 4/5.
4/5 to the power 59 in this calculator. Oh dear. So, okay. Now, the slight surprise is that this won't, as far as I know, I guess this is an advertisement for help for people who can calculate prefactors right. So, all my favorite theoretician friends, while they're here, we can have some fun with this while I'm getting it right. The slow modes, which I thought would do the business, actually don't. The reason I don't think they help with these observations of data is that if we've cleared out the polydispersity question, and I'm aware that the polydispersity may be the issue, but if it's not the issue, then we're looking for more modes at higher frequencies than low frequencies. But if we just calculate with the slow modes are dominated by the viscoelastic spectrum itself, more or less. So it's not quite true, but as a first approximation, you get a renormalization of the Platin modulus again. Oops, another one, but it lifts everything up because because then this little piece of slow mode stuff relaxes a little bit with the reputation time and a little bit with fluctuation times, and so that doesn't really help you very much. Revisiting the fast modes, however. Yes, Scott.
We're going to be looking at the word keep
pointing at rather than the number. When you say fast, keep pointing at fast. Oh, I'm sorry, I keep pointing fast. No, I should look at that fast. When I say fast, you should look at this, whatever I do with the stick. When I say slow, you should look at this, whatever the word says or whatever the stick says. I'm sorry. Prefactors, gosh, it gets worse than that. No wonder. No one ever agreed to referee a paper I wrote with anyone. Yes, so that's tau viscoelastic, and that's going to be slow, but it has small amplitude, and it appears more or less everywhere across the viscoelastic spectrum. This is fast. It has a huge amplitude, but it's fast. And it's fast for this cooperative diffusion constant. But if we put this into this integral, you get a very rapid power law. It's 5/2. I think I've got that right. And that all occurs at high frequencies. But it doesn't do anything structurally very interesting here. So this is some sort of theory for a Z equals 20 G double primed. Okay, and I claim it has quantum length fluctuations, reputation of which one. The lowest of these curves is a bare melt theory, roughly speaking, with all the processes talked about before. The fast mode ends up giving you a contribution which goes linearly in frequency in G double primed and quadratically in frequency with G prime. So it's as if there's a huge, big viscoelastic relaxation somewhere off to the right. It's a long way off to the right, but it can have a large amplitude, and it's very critical as to where that amplitude comes. So whether you take the cutoff, the order one place as to where you cut this thing off relative to the screening length can either make this negligible or make this rather large, as far as I can see. That's all I want to say. Yes, Mike?
Ratio,
what pressure
to the model say?
Oh, yeah.
If you normalize everything, it turns out from relations, volume, and you
want
to work.
Yes.
So what changes if you keep the same number of correlations?
Right. If you dilute but keep right, then you get a larger effect due to the fact that in... wait a minute, is this right? Is this right? The integral goes up to the correlation length. But everything comes from that shell. All this will come from a Q-space shell which sits at the correlation length.
So if I normalize my models in a sense that all the models inside the correlation volume, whether they relax or not, I call it one, effective module of one, as the module of per correlation volume.
Yes. I think the contribution, what I try to predict to give you here is the relative effect of this new contribution relative to the entanglement contribution which is there already. So I suspect this scales with the number of correlation volumes per tube volume. Yes, it changed constant in good solvent. Yes, I agree. It doesn't change a good solvent. So one qualitative prediction of this idea, sort of the idea, is that changing the solvent quality will change the rheology.
Right. relaxation time of correlation point changes or doesn't.
I don't think it changes.
Okay, so then that explains what was shown before, because that frequency that was an experiment was certainly much lower.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yes, no, sorry, actually, the data that I was looking at was not, when I wrote this down, was not the data Tam just showed you then. It was the data from a more mildly entangled solution there was no obvious bump at frequencies slightly higher than the platter modulus. What I was chasing was data that looked like just a fill-in of this trough. So, I mean, that's another reason why this is probably kind of a huge health warning, is that I have been exposed to very partial data sets. And so this looks very nice. If you were to look at the data that he showed me 2 weeks ago, you'd believe this more, because what that was looking at was just a filling in of, there was no particular extra frequency to the right of the peak here. It was all stuff filling in the trough here, which could be contributed by this. But I agree, it looks as if there's a lot more structure.
So why is it affecting this minimum?
Because you take an entanglement contribution, which looks like this, and you add this thing to it, and you move through this series of curves. I think it could, it actually can. What it also says is that you won't see Rouse scaling up here. You'll see a faster than Rouse power law up here. That's another. So there are various things. You'll see that. You'll see a concentration. You'll see a solvent quality dependence, and you'll see a concentration dependence. Lyndon wanted to. Yeah, that actually turns out to be way down. This is much smaller. So this is much larger than the bare solvent viscosity.
So the experiments you're describing, what temperature are they? What temperature
are they? The experiments he's actually describing. We use the temperatures within the bar of 0.35.
And the solvent is what?
Okay, Ron, do you have to go?
One way that this is a high frequency mode, the terminal time of which creeps into the data program.
Yes.
As a whole. One thing one could do is to subtract the melt kind of data from the solution data and get the spectrum,
in fact,
you can even turn
it
into H
as
a function of time, and you can
see what the spectrum
diversity would be all over the spectral space, where this thing would be some high frequency.
That's true. That's a nice idea. Okay, Scott.
I wonder
Tam. Yeah, no, okay. Can you do this?
A lot of my frequency data that were completely unroused. That is to say, the slopes of G prime and G double prime were diverging away from each other. They weren't parallel at all.
Which data are you talking about?
The one where you showed the
solutions. Of all the solutions?
Yeah.
Okay. I think I should be able to find it.
I was at that one, I think. This is going to work?
It's warming up.
Oh, okay. With a bit of luck. Okay,
sorry, nice. I didn't follow your comment. What was that?
Oh, yeah, pink.
I may be misremembering it, but what I recall was that high frequencies, the data of those solutions, is not anything like parallel.
You're right. Yeah, I was
going to say. Oh, no. Easily, please. I think that. That
should work now.
Everything's
plugging in.
Huh? Possibly.
Let me see.
There's a solvent contribution which I'm not certain that has been removed or not. These are data from Osaki's lab where it's one of his recent papers where he has a very large temperature difference in order to get the high frequency. And I have a feeling that there might be a solvent contribution that gets important at that stage. Is that right? Do you remember that?
Yes.
And if you subtract that out, they look fine.
But don't just say that it's way down. And now you are saying that it's enough to lift it up.
You kind of getting the solutions all mixed up. He's asking questions about Osaki's data, which is at a frequency here of 10 to the 4th. We were calculating it from my data, which was at a frequency of possibly 100 or something.
But we cross tau e, not 10 to the 4th. We cross tau e and we deviate immediately. We never go far, right?
Who is this we?
Same.
Which one are you talking? In this data? All I've shown here is essentially data that Osaki published recently where he has managed to go to high frequencies by using time temperature.
Oh,
we'll get this right. This data set is essentially data that was published recently with Osaki that has polystyrene. It happened to have the same number of entanglements as one of the solutions that I had, and it was essentially to compare that. This had some solvent viscosity, and his solvent, I think, was tritriodyl phosphate, which is a much more viscous solvent. We were calculating it for diethyl phthalate, which is less viscous. But I don't think there's a inconsistency.
It might be worth doing the sum because the fast mode integral just mimics a solvent contribution.
Yes.
So it's worth checking to see whether you really believe that's quantum. That's easy. I mean, no one has much doubt about the value of the solvent contribution to the viscosity. Mm.
No. No, I think that's fair.
But is this, are we looking at G?
Yeah, you can fit it perfectly without theory for so many decades if you subtract it. So it will be a surprise, man. It will be good news. I don't think.
But what slope? Slope of what? Well, if you look at the original paper of Osaki, he tries to take the slope here and tries to establish a Rouse time from that. And then compares it with some Rouse calculation that Ron suggested in your paper with Kat, and then with a correlation due to Gracely, and what else did he do? There were about four methods of calculating the Rouse time, and they differed by a factor of 7. This is paper published in 2001. Four different methods of calculating the Rouse time differed by a factor of 7, and the author concludes that he has no reason to choose one over the other. And that's the status of the calculation of time constants at this stage.
Coincidentally, you're on a related note. Yes, well, this brought the discussion back to anything.
This question is an important question. Hurwitz won the term in Tau-Rouse. And I think Osaki obviously struggled with that for many years.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, this is a person who spent a lot of time thinking about it.
So how does one do it?
And it is a worry that we can't seem to have an agreement on what the Rouse time should be. I mean, we keep saying if we had higher frequency data. Here we have free data which, goes where you can fit a slope of half, I think, and it still gives you a problem. The question is, what is the status of any model validation if we can't get the basic time constant right? There's always going to be that uncertainty.
One other issue which I wanted to just draw people's attention to between the answer to Ron's question, the candidate that Ron produced and the candidate that Alexei produced for a standard model differed most markedly in the treatment of constraint. And I think just one issue we should visit is
is the connection between tube dilation and RAS tube constraint release. So Ron effectively used tube dilation, aka double reputation, aka four thirds power law dilution. That is certainly problematic in the case of linear polymers. This we'll visit later. It may even turn out to be problematic in the case of star polymers. The alternative is to treat it as highly resolved model of constraint release. That sounds attractive because it's much better defined. You think you have control of what the little changes mean, but it does bring issues of its own, problems of its own with it. I mean, for example, there's no four thirds in the RAS tube picture. That's an advantage. You are constrained. You don't have a choice, as the tube dilation people do, of a dilation expert. But you do have a choice of seeing you.
Yeah, I'm not saying it's, I'm not saying there are fewer parameters.
So you have your alpha parameter in one case and your new parameter in the other case at least. That's not a question, it's just random.
Do we have comments on the general applicability of this one elongation of forming, which is presumably a non-linear or not deformation of tubes and everything versus linear shear of the Do you expect those to be principle or do you need to use only a theory for the name of zero? You're making a very, very fast pull on the chain. Mm-hmm. You're going at shear rate with a higher than the typical rotation time. Mm-hmm. So presumably you're deforming the tube. And nobody knows how to deform the tube.
Well, I thought we were going to test logic.
This is Kevin's performance is very slow to admit that your extension is closely divided by 3 is exactly.
We approach very close. I mean, I think one were, well, you know, in some cases, we get round ratios of about 2.7, 2.8. We haven't particularly tried very hard to go down to the extremely low frame rates because I thought all of us agreed that it should be 3 times. So it didn't seem to be a particular challenge to them, but I don't think that there's a problem. It's clearly approaching. But I don't know that that was the question you asked.
Yeah. I think you put one point in your plots, which corresponds to to shared data.
That was exactly a 3 times the shear stress, you just divide the eye. Is that the question you're asking, Mike? Or? Okay, I'm not certain I answered that at all.
I think it's measuring the RAS part.
I think all those times are going to change because of your deformed tube. And the retraction of the deformed tube time, or all of those times are going to have effectively different. So comparing times in linear response to time in the deformed tube is not quite fair because who knows.
I had understood our aim was to get these time constants in simple flows so you could actually use it for complex flow calculations. The tube definition might be significant.
You show the cartoon plot, which is very interesting to me, very except this is my understanding of user changes, right? And then there was some question about the middle skirt and the double time. That's a plot, which is identifying the plot. But in that plot, you have a point, which is that it's called R inverse.
Yes, actually, what I've done, I do recall that. And all I've done is I've essentially. Well, this one. Oh, these ones. Okay. These are essentially a caricature of Alexa's computations. They're really the same thing. And that's what they show, that these become important. The constraint release changes the slope around about the inverse Gauss time.
This is for 800 invariants. And if it's less, then you can see this condition, because something is small. So it's not a very experimental to determine the Gauss time, because it's all very, very broad spectrum.
Is correct that it's steeper before 100 values?
You mean directly around you? Using the calculation, you can take tau e.
That's not
times z squared, that gives you the Gauss time.
Yes.
Mm.
I mean, yeah.
And in fact, that's how we. In fact, that's basically how we determine the Rouse term of using the tau e.
Times z squared.
Yeah. As a single fitting parameter that covers all these, relates all these times.
I'm trying to remember correctly. The solutions have to go to the null if the concentration is 20%. So in my head, I'm trying to reconcile what you said and what Ken said. And he described a bunch of solutions that were 20% higher, and he described some solutions that are closer to 10%. Should I say that, you know, there's a crossover somewhere around 20%?
Yeah, tension is not big above 10. Everybody used to imagine it's a
demo. Yeah, we have 24 to 68.
100%. What's the difference?
Hmm?
What's the difference?
Some random molecules, I don't know, 3 years ago.
4 years?
3 years.
Ah, 3 years.
I think it's the molecular weight, not the concentration. No? Do you think it's the concentration?
If you compare things, it takes a number of entanglements.
Well, I mean, there's a huge jump in molecular weight because there's a huge jump in ME. Our melt ME is 1,000, and your melt ME is 13,000. So.
Yeah. Well, the chicken
level between 50 and 10, the
molecular weight should be
there. Right, but I'm just saying that from our 20% solution with a certain number of entanglements to 10% solution with the same number of entanglements is a big change in molecular weight because the ME is different.
Yeah, you're talking about the hydrogenated poly, so there's a factor of what, 10 or something, right?
Yeah, they are more than 10.
ME, your ME is what?
1,000.
So 13,000. Yeah, more than a factor of 10. There is the difference.
In amounts, you can compare for the time for the standard.
I have to make one point. We need to understand solutions because I think experimentally they're much more easy to handle. You get a much larger variation in parameter space than you would by just sticking to that zero. I don't think you're going to ever get enough data to severely constrain the theories if you just insist on working from that. I really think that if we can resolve that if these differences are either because of polydispersity or any other other effect that does not have anything to do with the basic tube model itself, then that becomes extremely convenient because it gives you a powerful tool to look at not only extensional flows but also other complex flow situations. I think it is. So there is a strong motivation for us to get this right.
And the nonlinear experiments are much simpler as well in terms of the stability is slick.
Yes, all those
things. just taste this for the future. Okay, so tomorrow again, Matthew and Linda.
Thank you.
And Ralph in the morning and more excitement in the afternoon.
I'm going to say two things. One, for those people who just arrived, it's, there's no way you'll get out of this building before 5 now, unless you really run for it. The only door by which you must leave the building after 5 is the front door. If you try to leave by any other, that's what they have the party chains. They put party paper chains across all other doors to remind you not to go through them after hours, because it sets off the alarm of the police service and the fire service, the ambulance will show up. So keep this front door only after hours, and make sure it's shut behind you. It should do that. Oh, thank you, Gary. Yeah, and don't, yeah, also make sure it shuts before 30 seconds, because if not, the police and fire and
then. You're not allowing your friends to open the door.
Oh, yeah, yes, it means yes, thank you. Yes. Shutting, reopening for every person who comes through. Please, sir, if you want to come to dinner tomorrow, our further restaurant, tell us how many are coming. It would be the end of the world if you were 10% out by the plateau value of the people who attend tomorrow night, but I'd like to get as happy as possible. Please sign up before you go. That's it. Thank you. But let's thank everyone who contributed to our meeting.